Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. All right, playing in Dublin against an Irish squad made up of bottom table Premier League and English Championship talent, the U.S. fell 2-1 on a 90th minute game winner from Brentford midfielder Alan Judge. This was a real test for a young American side. Ireland was a playoff loss to Denmark from qualifying for the World Cup in UEFA. Not a world power, obviously, but a solid European footballing nation fielding a team of men in their prime. Greg, how did the boys hold up in your opinion?
I wasn't as impressed with this game as I was with Paraguay. I thought we lacked a little bit of that courage, which is really the trademark that I want to see, courage on the ball, willingness to try to solve problems with passes and movement. So I thought that was lacking in large spells. I think, you know, I'm sure we'll get to each player, each line, but I thought it was sort of from back to front. I thought we were really weak in the back, and I think that caused a domino effect of no one really being able to look good.
Yeah, I would agree with that last part, especially. I thought the back line was a problem that sort of transferred itself throughout the field. Maybe we should just go ahead and start there.
Let's tackle that back line. I think it looked like Carter Vickers just didn't have any real composure. Was that your take on him?
Yeah, that's been true of him in the championship. He's not been a great distributor out of the back. He's a bulldog defender, but not great on the ball. I think we kind of already knew about that. That's my view on it. Is he gonna get better in that respect? And you know, what I saw from him on Saturday was pretty much par for the course, CCV-wise.
Okay, and I do think it's important to know you talked about Ireland sort of being, you know, their competent side.
Yeah.
So this is where you get into that, you know, the passing windows against Bolivia were enormous. You know, a lot of Bolivian guys were literally just taking plays off. Here, everyone on Ireland knew where they were supposed to be, and their shape was coherent, and you know, your window opens and closes very quickly before it's time to just have to launch a long ball. And I thought we put ourselves in that situation a lot of times where our only resort was to just hoof it forward.
Yeah, just a note on Ireland, they finished second in their group in qualifying, and then they lost in a two-leg playoff to Denmark. They drew Denmark away in Copenhagen, 0-0, and then in the home leg, they conceded a goal early. And my understanding is, I didn't watch the game, I've just read about it. My understanding is they totally changed their shape. You know, their calling card is they don't give up goals and they nick a goal here and there. Mm-hmm. You could kind of see that on Saturday.
Yeah, yep.
And they changed their shape completely after conceding early to Denmark because they knew they needed to get two goals. And they ended up losing 5-1.
Okay.
Which looks terrible, but in context, you know, they were pretty close. They were pretty close to being in the World Cup. And I saw, you know, Harry Arter came on late in the second half in the midfield. He's a good midfielder for Bournemouth, which is a mid-table Premier League side, and he wasn't a starter in this game. So, you know, they're pretty good. They're not Brazil, they're not Italy. Well, maybe they're Italy.
It might be Italy. Right. We weren't playing Germany or Spain over the weekend, but we weren't playing
Costa Rica or maybe Costa Rica, not Panama though. Better than Panama, I would say.
Right. So that's exactly what this was. This is a test. And while I know a lot of people, again, I feel like results drive the narrative a lot for US
sure
media
do.
Covering soccer. There were enough things to be critical of, but I feel like it's just sort of a really broad brush that we just paint. If we win, then everyone did well. And if we lose, then it's like, no one is quite as good as we thought they were. And I don't think that's the case. I feel like some of the guys that we were really excited about, most excited about after Bolivia. And again, I think we were all very measured with our optimism after Bolivia.
We sure were. But
the guys who we were like a little bit excited about either didn't play in this game. Keaton Parks, Anthony Robinson, Josh Sargent didn't start at least, or actually still played pretty well. Like I think Weston McKennie still played well. I think Tim Weah still played well. Weah isn't going to be as dangerous against a real team as he was going to be against a Bolivian amateur side. So the fact that he was dangerous every time he got it against Bolivia is a good sign. And the fact that he was able to be dangerous occasionally against a good Ireland team is also about what you'd expect.
Yeah, I agree with that too. Why don't we, I sort of interrupted your train of thought there, but we were starting off talking about the back line and how we couldn't distribute it forward. So let's talk a little more about that domino effect. Who are the main culprits in your mind? But you know, we already talked about CCV. How about the fullbacks?
I didn't think they looked good either. And I don't know if it was just confusion about whether they were being asked to play direct or if it was, you know, and part of that, sometimes there's a sort of a reverse effect where if the midfielders aren't working well to get available or if the shape just doesn't line up well with what Ireland's playing, then again, the windows won't exist to begin with. But Yedlin looked uncharacteristically sloppy with the ball. I know you're not as big on Yedlin as other people are, but I think Yedlin is a decent player who's capable of not squandering possession. But he looked out of sorts as well, I thought. I wonder if we can give him sort of that Christian Pulisic treatment of just being like the guy's ready for an off season.
You were the one who wasn't ready to give Pulisic that treatment last week.
Right. No, that's why I'm just curious if he'll get that same benefit of the doubt.
Seen that thought offered on the internet.
Viafania, I don't think even looked as clean as he usually does, and that's usually been his strength. So, it didn't look anywhere along the line like we were really comfortable with the ball at our feet in the back.
Yeah, Yedlin looked especially right-footed to me, and his right foot wasn't even that good. And there was that one back pass to the goalkeeper where, you know, you could argue Bilhamid should have shown for him a little better, but it went out for a corner kick.
It missed Hamid by like 15 or 16 yards, right?
Yeah. No bueno.
Mead made a break on it and couldn't even get close. So.
Right. And then there was that time where Viafania found himself, I don't know, 35 yards from goal in the middle of the field and then just hit it like a total fly ball into the stands. Like, I don't know if he was going for goal or I don't know what he was doing, but just decision making and technique from those fullbacks was really bad.
Yeah, and 30 even 35 yards, you're being kind to him. I think he was probably 45 yards out. He had one foot in the circle. It was really just looking like a Sunday screw around kind of decision. Like, yeah, this doesn't matter. What are we even doing out here?
Talking about like how results drive the narrative, there were a lot of people who were tapping the brakes on our midfield, saying, you know, McKennie, Adams, and Trapp didn't look that good. And I kind of disagree with that. I thought the midfield looked fine when they could get on the ball, and sure there's some onus on the midfielders to get on the ball. But if three or four guys on the back line aren't connecting passes, how are you gonna build anything coherent? Is kind of how I look at it, and I just think that particularly the fullbacks, the struggles of the fullbacks, hamstrung our midfielders in terms of getting on the ball and making productive things happen.
Right. So there definitely wasn't a ton of great things happening with that midfield three. I did see some, you know, again, I'm reading plenty of the other analysis of the game and seen some stuff about how the issue was we didn't have a playmaker in central midfield. And then like the next sentence was like, unlike in Bolivia where we had Christian Pulisic there, which just seems bizarre to put those two sentences next to each other to somehow, you know, imply that Christian Pulisic was pulling the strings for all of our success in the 3-0 Bolivia win, when it was really, you know, very much in spite of Christian Pulisic there that we had some success. So,
yeah, let's come after that point in particular, that we need a creative playmaker in this 4-1-4-1 or 4-3-3, whatever you call it. And that was our problem against Ireland. I completely disagree with that.
if you're going to make that case, it really, again, just doesn't seem like Christian Pulisic is the guy you're trying to make a case for. It seems like you'd be making a case for Sasha Kljestan or the next coming of Sasha Kljestan. I don't know that anyone's trying to do that. Like, I know Doyle was saying he wanted to see a more creative midfielder, but he didn't actually name one, so I don't know if Pulisic is his idea of that or if he really did want a, you know, a 31-year-old Sasha Kljestan called in for this camp. Because I don't know who you'd consider our current playmaker. Like, who would that be for you?
I think McKennie's our best playmaker at the moment.
That's what I would say too.
Yeah. Now I acknowledge that playing the 10 is not really where he long term fits into a soccer team, but he created some stuff on Saturday in a relatively quiet performance, I thought. I feel like if you can get McKennie on the ball, wherever you can get him on the ball, even if that's in your own half, he may not be making the killer pass, but he's making passes that wrong foot the defense and open up space. Even if he was a six like he was against Bolivia, he's making passes from deep that spring attacking moves. And I think as long as you have that, you don't need to shove a square peg into a round hole in the 10 position. You know, I feel like we've sort of been over this ground already, but
no, I agree. And I think that the other element you need, the other ingredient you have to have, if you're going to be relying on like a McKennie to create, would be really like dangerous wingers. And I think, you know, I think we've gotten a glimpse of that with Tim Weah. I still am not convinced on, sorry, I'm not necessarily convinced on Weah. You see that it's the potential for that is there with him. Whether he hits that potential consistently or not, we don't know. I don't know. We've seen a ton of that from Rubio Rubin.
No.
So we're really hoping. Well, I mean, obviously we have a Christian Pulisic. We know will give us that as well. I tend to be in agreement with you. This game wasn't a great advertisement for. I don't think it was a great advertisement for McKennie, Adams, and Trapp. I guess I would call it inconclusive.
Yeah. Well, I think everybody who listens to this show knows that I'm like deep in the can for McKennie. I'm a huge fan, and I think he's, you know, arguably at this point the most important player in the pool, and that includes Pulisic. So I thought it was a fine advertisement for him. I counted two, maybe three sort of ugly giveaways from him, which he's sort of good for a couple of those every game. And he also didn't play well after his sort of bright moment with that touch over the defender and the volley with his left foot. I thought he was gassed after that. But other than that, he was excellent. Every time he touched the ball, it was positive. And it was quick and it was thoughtful. So I don't agree. I thought it was a great advertisement for McKennie, generally speaking.
Well, don't get me wrong, Bells. This was like a very carefully constructed sentence. I didn't think it was a great advertisement for McKennie, Adams, and Trapp in that configuration.
I see. Okay. Okay.
You know what I mean? Like I'm with you. McKennie is a nailed on. Like he is arguably our best player. So I don't have. It's going to be some configuration that will include McKennie, and we have to figure out what that is. So again, I'd say inconclusive for Adams. Sure seems like he belongs on the field, but we don't know where yet. We don't know if that's as an eight or wide, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's just so, just for that particular configuration, I don't know that we got a lot of positives to take from it one match.
I would agree with that. I thought, you know, Trapp had some nice moments and he was pretty clean. And, you know, people talk about, well, he's good at distributing from deep. Well, okay, but what does it mean to be good at distributing from deep? Is it you can just shuttle it back and forth repeatedly, or, you know, hit the sort of Bradley diagonal every now and then?
It's called the Durkin diagonal at this point, Bells.
True that.
No, Durkin's kind of in the clips you've managed to put together on him. Like that's something that comes to my mind when you say distributing from deep.
I think with Durkin, what I like to think he will offer eventually is a little bit more penetrative quality with his distribution from deep. Passes that break the lines or beat defenders. And I guess that's what I'm saying about Trapp is I don't know that he offers that much of that. Am I wrong about that?
No, I don't think so. I think he plays pretty high percentage balls, and I don't think you could try to build your offense around a system that requires that, and then have Will Trapp be your guy. Like that won't be a successful system around Will Trapp. I think he does need to be more of like a shuttler who will occasionally ping a really good ball that switches the point of attack in a way that sets up, you know, a Nagby or a Weah to be dangerous. I'm using Nagby there because I feel like he's a really good guy to get himself into space and exploit a little bit of a numbers advantage in a short window.
Okay, so that's Trapp and McKennie, and I want to come back to where McKennie lands eventually for the national team in that midfield. But let's talk about Adams a little bit. I think he played the full 90. He was energetic as usual. He certainly doesn't look out of place out there. I think he looks fine. What's your analysis?
Did it seem like he just seemed underused? Like I can think of one sequence where it's like I felt like we had half the team sort of trying to play with one mindset and the other half playing like a different mindset. And I'm talking about Adams' moment of transition. Like he takes the ball off of Bolivia and he's got open field in front of him and we're attacking at full speed and Villafania's coming up around him on the left. And so I feel like that is the perfect Tyler Adams moment. You know, I mean, running full speed of the defense, we've got three or four other guys streaking forward. And he eventually, you know, he waits for a defender to commit, feeds it to Villafania. And then Villafania just holds the ball up there. Mm. And it's like, no, like we can't. We're not going to now build and let Ireland set and then break them down. Like,
right.
We have to just go at them right there. And most of the time when we do that, we'll still lose the ball. But we have to take that moment in the transition, and that's where we have to try to take our chance.
Yeah.
And we need to just do that. We need to do that 10 or 12 times in the game to see if we can steal something. But I feel like we were that was sort of the differing mindsets of an Adams and a McKennie who would want to just run and other guys who were just going to slow it down.
Yeah. I mean, that's an example of Villafania doing it. I mean, Yedlin also, there were like, I don't know, four or five times where he would get the ball on the right wing and he would just step on it and try to cross it from the sideline. And that's such a low percentage ball, and he's not even good at hitting those balls anyway.
Right.
I don't understand. Like, you're the fastest guy on the field. Take him to the end line.
And right, you're super fast. You've got Tim Weah over there who's really fast. Like, that's what that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, I feel like we have guys who want to just, like, race forward. And that's where I thought we needed to play. I thought we needed more of that style against Ireland.
Yeah, so that goes a little bit back to the fullbacks being timid, or maybe their instruction was to just lump it in into the box and hope for Bobby Wood to get a goal, which he did. He did later.
Yeah, that's what we did.
First half. My thought on Adams, it's interesting you say he looked like he was ready to race forward all the time, because the thing that kept occurring to me about Adams as I was watching him was he seemed timid to me, not quite as ambitious with the ball, trying to play it safe. Now, I'm not saying he did that every time, but I found myself wishing he would, you know, try to step past a defender, try to beat a guy and open up some space, and he would kind of pull it back and roll it back to Miazga or roll it back to Villafania. Maybe that'll come with time, but it's hard for me not to sort of slide it into my existing narrative of, you know, Adams not being 100% comfortable with the, you know, 360-degree nature of soccer in the middle of the park.
Well, I think I mostly agree with you there, and that's what I mean about him being – he was almost like underused in that game. Like, if you have Tyler Adams, you shouldn't be using him to just like – you know, like collect it, slow down in midfield and play it back to Miazga. Like he should be a guy who, even if he is playing a simple ball, should then be bursting forward off of the ball.
Yeah.
And I just, yeah, I'm with you. I don't think there were enough times where he got to really show off that burst.
So there's a certain amount of this that we can just sort of chalk up to being, you know, they're coached by a coach who really isn't an international level coach, and they've only been together for a couple weeks. There's, you know, I mean, we could just sort of like throw that blanket disclaimer on top of all of this. I think tactically, you can, what do you expect? You know, do you expect everybody to be fully utilized? Unless you have anything more on Adams, I'd like to jump back to McKennie. And do you have anything more on Adams?
No, let's get more of the McKennie, because McKennie, I feel like, was the brightest spot.
Yeah. Well, one last thing on Adams is he and McKennie did have a few nice passing combinations, and there was one in particular that resulted in a Bobby Wood right-footed shot from just inside the box, where he, you know, maybe could have passed it to Weah, who was open on to his right.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
That was a really nice. That was a really nice flowing move up the left wing. Bobby Wood held up a headed ball. I don't remember from whom, and then found the feet of Rubio Rubin on the left wing. Rubin found McKennie's feet, you know, sort of in the left channel, and McKennie and Adams just did a quick tap, got back to McKennie, and he sort of rounded the ball just inside the box, and then just passed it off to Wood, who then turned and took a relatively tame shot on goal.
Yeah, yep, I remember that, and I'll at least defend Wood's decision to shoot. I feel like Wood's read in that, like as the defenders were closing him down, was that the defender on Weah's side closed Wood down with the intention of denying the pass to Weah, essentially forcing the shot from there rather than closing Wood's shot, allowing Wood to feed Weah for a wide open attempt facing the goal.
Yeah,
in other words,
that's fair.
But I know exactly what you're talking about. And yeah, the point is, again, very fluid movement and connecting from McKennie, Adams, and a couple of guys surrounding him.
Yeah, I mean, Rubin shows those flashes of quality here and there. Just would like to see him put it together for 60 minutes, you know, 60, 70 minutes. Back to McKennie. I communicate with this guy on Twitter who pointed out to me that McKennie has sort of a lingering problem with tendonitis in his knees. And this guy pointed this out to me like 2.5 months ago, and I had even seen the interview where he talked about it, where McKennie talked about it, and it hadn't quite registered with me. But if you watch McKennie at Schalke, and then you see him against Ireland, and even to some extent against Bolivia, which was a cakewalk, he really does slow down at about the 70-minute mark. And this guy that I DM with on Twitter, I asked him if he wanted me to identify him, but he hasn't responded yet, so I won't. It's just some guy who follows the national team really closely. He said he thinks that's going to be a real limiting factor for McKennie going forward, you know. I mean, unless they come up with some miracle cure for tendonitis.
I'm looking that up right now, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of bugged me since he told me about it. Now I'm not saying I'm not a doctor. I don't know, you know, obviously this is just talky talk, but McKennie admits he has tendonitis. He does seem to slow down around the 70th minute. That makes me think, you know, maybe he does fit best at the six long term for the national team. He wouldn't have to run constantly. He wouldn't have to be pressing all the time. He'd be able to get on the ball more often, presumably, and connect with two other midfielders. So even though he is our best playmaker right now in the center of the midfield, that's just a shout to say, like, I used to think of him as like a definite box-to-box guy. And over the last couple of months, I've sort of been swinging towards like, hey, maybe he should be at the six. Now, I don't know what that means for Chris Durkin or Michael Bradley. Yeah, you know, he'll probably play plenty of the eight over the next few years, but just a thought.
So indirectly, you're kind of making the case that the U.S. should base its shape around McKennie first and then everyone else after, right?
I guess.
I'm not putting words in your mouth there, am I?
No, I mean, I think at this point, it's an open question. Does McKennie fit better as an 8 or a 6? Don't you think? We don't really know yet.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So this is just a suggestion that maybe there will one day be a reason to vote for him to be at the 6.
Okay. So these could be some extenuating circumstances that might affect that decision-making process.
Yeah. I think it's something to keep an eye on.
Right. And so I'll monitor a lot of medical journals, and I'll monitor Schalke very closely, and we'll see if they can address that problem.
The Journal of Orthopedics. Yeah. No, there was an interview with McKennie on some – it wasn't the official Schalke channel, but it was a German-language interview back in the summer before – during preseason. It was like three parts, and McKennie talked about his friendship with Pulisic. He talked about a lot of different things. But there was a point where the interviewer said, hey, you got outrun by Naldo in one of the drills today, and the manager, Tedesco, was really giving you grief for it, saying you should never get outrun by a 36-year-old. You're 19 years old. And McKennie laughed, and he said, yeah, you know, he knows I have tendonitis in my knees, and I start to wear down after a little while out there. It's something we're working on, you know, something to that effect. And I remember watching that and not really registering with me. But when you see over the course of the season that he does seem to slow down a lot, 65th to 75th minute, somewhere in there, especially when he's in one of those forward central midfield positions where he's just pressing all the time, which is kind of what he does for Schalke and kind of what he did for the U.S. in the Portugal match. So there you have it.
Yeah, that's, again, one of those sort of human moments or those human issues where, like, we tend to think of players just as these machines. But, yeah, you can be limited by physiology at times.
Yeah. I mean, we're all just finite. We're all just finite humans, which makes me, you know, which makes me really glad that Pulisic is not being forced to play in these games. And anytime an American player of talent doesn't have to play in a meaningless game. I mean, I'm glad that we have the guys that we have for these Ireland and France friendlies, because I think it's a good time to build some cohesion, but I'm never going to object.
Right. We definitely want Timmy Chandler in that locker room for the friendlies saying, hey, listen, what are you doing, man? Like, go home and rest. You don't need to play in this game.
Yeah, but he wasn't saying that about a friendly. He was saying that
about... we just need to call him in for the friendly camp. Let's let him work a booth at the friendlies. Keep him away from qualifiers.
Time wears away all the pleasures of the day, all the treasures you could hold. Days turn to sand, losing strength in every hand.
Let's move forward in the lineup here, talk about the wingers. I mean, we kind of already talked about Rubin. I'm sort of in a if everybody falls into a buy, hold, or sell category, to use the stockbroker's parlance, I just think Rubin's just kind of a hold. He's fine. I don't my opinion of him hasn't changed over these last 180 minutes.
I'll say over 180 minutes they have, but it's mine have just changed to, again, meaning he's a competent placeholder when we don't have the entire pool available.
Okay, I can agree with that.
I didn't have him in that mode before these games. I really was just like, I thought he was a very speculative call up, going back to Paraguay.
Okay. So he's not on the savior committee, but he's maybe working in the mailroom. Something.
Yeah. He's drinking buddies with somebody who is on the committee.
Okay.
And if they happen to be out together and you need another player, you're like, hey, just ask your buddy to come play.
Excellent. Yeah. Weah got a lot of, I think, got a lot of praise after this match, but I thought it was a little disproportional to his performance. he had that really nice touch with his chest on a long ball from trap to get around a guy, and then he lost the ball, and Yedlin picked it up and passed it to Wood for another shot that went just wide. He has nice moments of combination and so forth, but I'm not ready to. I guess I put him firmly in the category of promising young player, but not a starter and not a guaranteed call up in a first choice roster either.
I'd be okay with that, but well, I guess I don't know, for a first choice roster right now. I feel like I'd have him in, and this goes back to my sort of framework for evaluating these guys. And a lot of times it's against who would have been playing that position historically for us. Yeah. So I'm not putting him up against other prospects like a Jonathan Amon who I haven't seen yet. I'm putting him up against, you know, like we went to a World Cup with Graham Zuzi and Ali Bedoya as our outside mids. And our most dangerous midfielder in that World Cup turned out to be DeAndre Yedlin when he'd come in for 10 minutes at the end of a game. So for me, like right now, I had no idea if he was going to, you know, look comfortable in these games for these first call-ups after, you know, sparse minutes with PSG. I think he has looked very comfortable to the point where I'd be like, yeah, like I would be fine with him being in a World Cup 2018 game over Graham Zuzi or Ali Bedoya.
Yeah, I guess that's a really good point, and I keep forgetting that that's really been the standard for the last decade, is those guys. And yeah, I mean, my biggest criticism of Weah is that he, you know, in front of goal, he's been kind of scattered and hasn't been able to put anything in the back of the net, despite, you know, quite a few pretty decent chances. And, you know, if that's the standard, then yeah, he'd be just as good at that as Bedoya or Zusi, and Bedoya and Zusi wouldn't even get into those spots probably. So
right, and so I'll say this too, because I know you talk a little bit about him lacking a little bit of end product. In some ways, I disagree. Like, I think he needs to work on his technique for that last touch. But when I think about somebody lacking end product, I mean they never even make the last touch. Like they put the ball in play, they never make the last touch themselves, and they never put somebody else in position to even make the last touch to score a goal. And that's where I've always thought, like, Bedoya fell. Weah's been in position to make the last touch. Like, he's hit it, and he just hasn't put it on frame, or he hits it straight at the keeper. And then he obviously has put in his goal in his three appearances. He's managed one that he finished. But he had a decent hit or a decent chance against Ireland that he skied a volley, didn't he?
Yeah, a sort of a busted clearance kind of bounced into his path, and he took it down with one touch, and then ball was still bouncing, and he hit it just over the crossbar. I mean, should have put that on frame. But
yeah, I agree with that. But for me, that is like not a lack of end product. That is him in the right spot, able to like hit a ball well, and you know, again, guys will miss that all the time.
Yeah. Okay.
So I like Weah, and if it came down to like I'm trying to think of who I would have just I think in January, did we start Zardes on the wing again in January? Like,
yes, I believe so.
So I have Weah ahead of Zardes as a winger. Like, so in the current pool, like on the strength of just a few games, I think Tim Weah has made a good case that he would belong.
Okay, I'm going to retract what I said. He gets to be in the first team roster.
There we go.
You got
on board with Weah.
Yeah.
And now you won't have to deal with all this mail calling you a Weah hater.
Yeah, so much mail in my mailbox.
And I should note that we're not even talking about email. People legitimately write you letters and send them to your address.
Handwritten letters. I don't even know how they get my address. It's crazy. No, that's not true, everybody. Not true at all. I guess the last starter before I defer to your goalkeeping wisdom on Mr. Hamid is Bobby Wood. And I think Bobby kind of fits into the general, for me, my general feeling on the game, which was overall not too bad. He looked competent, relatively effective for large stretches of the game. He got the goal, which relates to another guy we really haven't talked about, who is Matt Miazga. This was a free kick from the right side of the field, hit by Trapp to the back post. Matt Miazga rose and headed it back across into the corridor of uncertainty, and Wood latched onto the end of it, just kind of cushioned it into the net. Really impressive goal for me on a lot of levels. Good free kick by Trapp. Miazga demonstrated that he's once again, that he's a real set piece asset, which is a huge thing I think we maybe didn't have too much of in qualifying. And then the way Wood judged that ball and got on the end of it was, I thought, pretty impressive. Got a goal right before the half.
Yeah, and I think Wood showed you that he still offers you all the things that he did before this sort of horrendous season for his club side in Germany. The Paraguay game, he was pretty bad. And I think we while recognizing that, we were also able to say he probably hasn't completely regressed as a player. And I'd say today was the evidence for that. He looked very Bobby Woodish again today.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, not today. In the Ireland contest. So
yeah, Saturday.
That was such a Bobby Wood goal, right? Just work really hard in the box, anticipate that something might go right for you, and when it does, like, be there to get on the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you happy to see his name? Not, I shouldn't say happy. Were you upset to see his name in the starting 11?
No. I'm totally fine with it. And I was mostly fine with his performance. I thought he justified the start in large part, not just because of the goal, but his hold-up play was pretty good. I guess the thing where I think Sargent offers something that he doesn't offer is just quality combining with other attackers. And we saw a little bit of that against Bolivia from Sargent against weak competition. We saw a little bit of it on Saturday when Sargent came on for the last 20 minutes. But Sargent's just a better passer, has better vision, and is a little more, I don't know, three-dimensional with the ball at his feet than Wood. And I thought Wood's lack of vision and instinct to combine did stunt the attack somewhat. And I thought Sargent would have made a difference there if he'd come on earlier. But like I said, I wasn't mad that Wood got to play. I thought he played pretty well. He just doesn't have the upside that Sargent has.
Right. So that's kind of going to go right into one of my next question is, do you think we learned anything different, anything new about Bobby Wood in that game?
Not really. Other than what you said, which is like maybe he's regressing back to, or progressing back to his mean. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That maybe we learned that. Maybe we learned he hasn't like completely lost his ability to play the game.
So that's I'm with you there too. I was disappointed a little bit to see him starting, precisely because Bobby Wood is Bobby Wood. Like we didn't need to see him in that game. And I told you this too when I saw the lineup. That's going to play out eventually. Like the Wood versus Sargent issue is going to. I mean, there are two guys competing for the exact same sort of type of position. There's plenty of time to determine who the better one is and through their club performances and national team performances. I just thought this was a really, as a fan, a really good check to see if Sargent like was able to play at the next tier of competition. Like he had just done it against Bolivia in as he called it, a cakewalk. So I don't want to anoint Josh Sargent the starter through the next cycle or finally the best forward in U.S. history. But I did want to see, is he able to like look similar? Like, can he look that comfortable as he did against Bolivia in a tougher match? So that's why I actually was disappointed to see Wood, and it was just because I felt like, again, as an experiment, why not give Josh Sargent the next run out against a more capable team?
I mean, I tweeted during the game that I wanted Sargent to come on at halftime, even after the Wood goal. But I guess it's probably hard for a manager who has a striker who just scored a pretty nice goal to pull him off right at the half. I would have liked to see Sargent for the entire second half. And I would still like to see him start against France, because I just think he offers a little bit more, and I don't think there's a huge drop off on the evidence we have. There's not a huge drop off in his ability physically to handle the demands of the international game. That is Sargent's. I think he seems to be able to handle it just fine. So let's see how he does in the other facets. I mean, throwing him up against MTT and Varone is going to be, you know, that's just another level than even anything in the Bundesliga, pretty much. But why not?
Yeah, so let's get to that one in a second. Do we want to go through the last starter in the match, the Hamid performance, we'll call it?
Yeah, I mean, you're the goalkeeper. My sense was he had a bad game, and what's your sense?
he looked, and not just on the goal that everyone's going to talk about, the one where he took himself out of the goal, couldn't get through a sea of bodies to make a play on the ball, and then also couldn't recover to get back in a position like that. Those look terrible, and they're pretty. It's a pretty bad decision. There were other times where he clearly was going to get to the ball, where for whatever reason he didn't seem to communicate it with his back line. So like he's taking the ball off of Matt Miazga's head. And it happened, I think, at least twice, to the point where Miazga is actually turning and remonstrating that, like you have to let me know so, you know, I don't look terrible heading the ball into my own goal. Right. So something about him, just about Hamid, he must have just been lacking confidence, or lacking, you know, he just wasn't assured in his control of balls in the air.
Yeah, the Miazga remonstration. That would be a good title for a novel. My sense of, you know, I'm not a student of Hamid's career, but my sense of him is he's always been an excellent shot stopper, but not so great at the other stuff, you know, the sort of the full panoply of goalkeeper responsibilities. And he sure wasn't comfortable coming out of the goal mouth and making decisions and communicating those.
And yeah, and it's not like he's an excellent passer of the ball when we're playing with feet. So so this is one of those things where, again, there's always really small data sets on goalkeepers because so few actions take place in the goal mouth. The ones that did take place, he didn't really cover himself in glory. It can be really hard to like really stake a claim to a position, to the goalkeeper position, to a starting spot, but it can be pretty easy to sort of lose it, as we saw with Horvath and his howler against Portugal. And now Hamid has kind of done the same. So Zach Steffen seems to be moving up on the charts just sort of through by default.
Yeah, by inertia. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just pulling away by doing nothing at all. I mean, who are the other two goalkeepers in this camp? Horvat's there, right? And then William Yarbrough plays in Liga MX. Does he play for Carataro or something? I don't know.
I'm not sure. That's how much I assumed William Yarbrough will not be seeing game time.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. I guess we'll see. It might get there by process of elimination. Hamid hasn't been playing regularly for his club in Denmark, Michelin. It's probably worth noting too. So, you know, argument is maybe he was just rusty, needs to really fight for regular playing time this fall. We'll see what happens, but it does seem like he dropped in the pecking order. Couple before we get to France, I just wanted to say I thought, sort of big picture, you and I talked about this off the air, but the press looked, the U.S. press looked like it wasn't really very well coordinated, and you know, like one guy would press, but nobody would come with him, or somebody else would press and Wood wouldn't press. You would agree with that, right?
Yeah, I would go so far as to say in those cases you can't even really call it a press. Like when you say a press, like it'd be like in basketball if like one guy just decided to linger after a rebound and see if he could nick the ball off. Like that's not really a press. It's just one guy freelancing, being opportunistic.
Okay.
I don't think there was any design to actually press. Occasionally, I think we did respond to somebody freelancing, and all of a sudden our line of confrontation would be much higher up the field. But a lot of the times I thought we just sort of fell back into like that 4-4-1-1 and just were just going to keep our shape until Ireland gave the ball away.
Okay. Yeah. Well, our shape, whatever it was, whether there was a press, whether there was an intentional press involved or not, I thought when we did have a high line of confrontation, there were times where we created openings that way, you know, like Adams closing quickly on somebody, or I think even Wood, maybe Sargent a couple times late in the game. And I would like to see more of that. I'd like to see us, you know, really challenge a defense to play through us, because it did create a few opportunities. We just didn't have the quality in the attacking third to exploit those, quality or decisiveness, which we already sort of talked about when you mentioned Adams be racing forward. He'd roll it out to the wing, and one of the fullbacks would just sort of step on it. But I was encouraged by the few times when our high line of confrontation did seem to create a little bit of an opening for us.
Yeah, and that could definitely lend itself towards a more organized, more intentional press, with, you know, trying to get all 11 guys into it and sort of making it a little more coherent. Because I'd agree, I thought there were instances where we use those turnovers that individuals create as our playmakers. And that definitely looks like it could be a viable approach for our player pool.
Our fullbacks didn't look good. We agree on that. Do you think one of them should be replaced against France, or both of them? Shaq Moore came on again for Yedlin in the last 20 minutes or so. I thought he looked okay, pretty good. Maybe an Olasunde-esque performance.
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough to really get a lot of like info on Shaq Moore from that cameo. I feel like they got around him a couple of times. Where if there's one thing you got to have if you're going to try to beat out Yedlin, I think, is 1v1 defending. Because I personally think Yedlin is a very good 1v1 defender.
Mm-hmm. He is.
So
he's good at that.
I definitely don't want to like sacrifice that. So, you know, I don't know. I'd say
you don't want to experiment with a shaky 1v1 defender against Kylian Mbappe and Usman Dembele.
It's going to be a very sink or swim situation for whoever starts against France. And so I wouldn't care if Shaq Moore started. And I guess I'll just say this as we sort of end up talking about France later, but this will be like the opposite of Bolivia. Like, I don't think anyone can play themselves out of their status with a tough game against France.
Yeah.
I think if you play really, if you look good though against France, that is, then you can draw a lot of conclusions from that.
Yeah, I'm an optimist, but I'm not feeling it. I don't think this is going to be an American bloodbath, a bath of American blood, to be clear. Yeah, I thought there was one moment where Shaq Moore stepped past. He took a pass from Tim Parker, who came on for a CCV around the 60th minute at center back. I thought Parker looked a little bit better than CCV, and not dramatically better, but a little bit better. Parker played a pass to Moore that was just a little, the weight was a little off, so Moore had to sort of reach for it, and he stepped past the defender and split two defenders, created a little space, calmly played a pass to somebody in the midfield, and that just made me, just the rhythm and harmony of that kind of made me feel good watching. And I wanted to see more of that from our other fullbacks. But
right. That was a breath of fresh air after the previous 70 minutes.
Yes, exactly. Is there anybody else that we should talk about who played? Luca Della Torre, I thought, didn't really belong out there.
Right. No, I mean, I really don't think so.
You seem to be pretty high on Sargent's 20-minute cameo.
I thought it was good. I thought it was. I thought he did a lot of things better than Bobby Wood did over Bobby Wood's 70 minutes. And it goes back to what we said about the Bolivia game. Like, if you watched just those 90 minutes of soccer and didn't know anything else about Josh Sargent, you wouldn't say that this is a guy who's never played a professional minute. You wouldn't be like, ah, he just doesn't look ready.
Right. Yeah.
He looks like a good prospect. Like you'd be like, oh, okay, this is one of the US's he could easily be in our stable of forwards that we've been calling up when Altidore isn't available.
Yep. Okay. Joe Corona made an appearance, but it wasn't anything terribly notable about it. And I think that's it. Keaton Parks didn't dress.
Did we get any was there any word on that? I kind of didn't see anything.
No, I didn't see anything either.
Just a manager's decision.
They can only have a certain number dress, and we have more than that in our roster. So if somebody doesn't dress, I don't know if there's that much more to it. I mean, maybe it means Sarakin doesn't rate Parks. It's hard to see that after the way Parks played against Bolivia, but who knows? Let's talk about France. You ready for that?
Yes. Let's get into this actual. I mean, this is more than a test. Like this is real, the real thing. I don't care that it's a exhibition game. I trust that all of these guys are like amped about getting to play this French team.
You think so?
Oh yeah. Like for this group that we have, based on sort of everything we kind of know about their makeup, like they're just. This has got to be like the most exciting game of their so young American careers.
Yeah. And this is going to be, I think all reports are, this is going to be a first choice French squad because people are fighting for starting positions and, you know, there's real, you know, substantive experimentation going on by their manager. Is his name Deschamps, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're likely to see 11 absolutely world-class players and you know, people are predicting it could be really ugly for the U.S. Do you think it? I mean, of course it could be. Do you think it will be?
I don't, and only because I think the U.S. will sort of take on this fighting for our lives mentality. Like I kind of think that we'll play like more of a Bob Bradley style, like. Be organized, be mean as hell, and just don't like. I don't think we're going to try to like be wide open and run against them. I just don't think that's the attitude the kids are going to take, or certainly that Sarakin's going to take.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to counterattack at some point, but you're saying not get stretched and run up and down the field over and over again.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to be playing this wide open, like, all right, we're just going to spread out and carve them up with our passing. I think it'll be very much like look for chances to counter.
Mm, yeah.
Get Adams and Weah running when we can.
The thing that worries me the most about the game is like, is Tim Parker going to do Dembele's knee or or Kylian Mbappe's knee and then, you know, get assassinated before he leaves the country? But I guess you want him to try hard.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, as fans of the game, I definitely don't want any of these French stars to miss the World Cup on account of, I don't want the U.S. to become sort of the villains that a Nigel de Jong became.
Yeah, right. Well, who do you have any thoughts on how you would line them up out there?
So I would take all the kids we've played who have looked good, like I would start them, like, and just sort of give them this chance. And again, try to take the weight off them and just be like, what we're expecting is like you're a good player and like we just want you to go out and show it. And if Anthony Robinson starts left back and gets, you know, left for dead on a couple of combination plays that France just sort of abuse, like, okay, good. Like we'll learn from it. And I don't think anyone's going to get knocked out of the U.S. picture because they don't look great against the eventual World Cup champions.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought if you take the, even with the level of competition as a caveat, you take the recent performances of Viafania and Robinson, you got to give Robinson a chance here, I think.
Yeah, and this is where my grade on Sarakin would be an incomplete right now, because if Sarakin does play Viafania over Robinson, then I'll retroactively be mad that Robinson didn't start against Ireland.
Yeah.
Because again, that would have been your chance to, all right, we'll test him against a competent team, you know, because Bolivia was not. Test him against a competent team, see how he looks there. And if your intention is to trot out what you think is your best team against France, then Robinson, I feel like, should have gotten the minutes against Ireland.
Yeah, agree. And I think the same formula applies to Parks too.
Yes.
I'll be mad at Sarakin for not playing him against Ireland if he also doesn't play against France. So that would be nice to see. So, okay, let's say Robinson at left back. You're sticking with Yedlin at right back, I guess.
Yes, yep. Yedlin at right back. Give me Miazga, and then I kind of don't care. I mean, CCV didn't look great, but I don't believe that Parker or Eric Palmer Brown is going to look great against France either.
Yeah. I mean, Parker will offer – I think Parker offers a little bit more stability than those two. I don't know.
All right, so let's call it Parker. Let's say it's Parker then at center back for France.
Hey, should we – you know, speaking of Miazga, just thought we should mention this because people have brought it up. The second goal for Ireland, that 90th-minute game winner, he got done pretty good by James McLean, I think. Did you, yeah. do you hold that against him?
The sort of and one video of Miazga getting destroyed by that guy. I don't. The fact that we put a center back in a position where he was trying to defend two guys in the box off of the ball, and which means he's got to kind of split the difference and try to be able to defend both of them should the ball go to one of them. When the ball goes to the Irish attacker that it goes to, now Miazga has to step to a guy who's literally just going to face him up from how far out was the Irish player when he received it? 15 yards?
From the goal, yeah. I'd say it was just inside the box, right?
So, yeah. So, at that point, Miazga is alone. He's got the guy on the ball plus another attacker who eventually scores it to deal with because we got ourselves so out of position. We sent, like, three players out to the ball on the sideline and didn't emerge with it. So, I think we basically put him in an impossible situation. He didn't do great. I mean, he didn't make a heroic play, but that's what it would have taken. Any successful play from him there would have been heroic because he has to deny the shot from that guy. He has to deny a slipped pass into the guy who eventually scored, or he has to deny the guy beating him himself on the dribble. And you can't do all three of those things. So, you know, it's a team failure to put your center back in a position where somebody has just received the ball alone in the box, you know, 15 yards from the goal with several options. Like, there's no one in our pool that's going to come out of that looking good.
Okay, cool.
That's my Miazga take.
No, that's good. That's helpful. I thought we should cover that. So Miazga, Parker, Robinson, Yedlin. Do you care who's that goalkeeper?
Stefan. I want to see Stefan in this game because this is a chance to actually stake a claim. Like when you play against France's first team, you are going to have plays to make. This is sort of like Tim Howard versus Spain in the Confederations Cup, or I mean, you're going to be offered opportunities to make plays in this game.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Stefan. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Stefan at goalkeeper. How are you lining up the midfield?
So I probably I'm less risk averse in these friendlies because my livelihood doesn't depend on it. I put Keaton Parks in as the six, and I run McKennie and Adams together as eights.
Okay. I'd be happy with that. I could switch Parks and McKennie and also be happy apropos of our earlier discussion of his tendonitis. But those three seem to me like the ones most fans would like to see, and I see no reason that they shouldn't be the ones out there.
Well, you see no reason that they shouldn't be, but do you fully expect Will Trapp to start?
I 75% expect Will Trapp to start.
Yeah, I'm like 90% that Will Trapp start. And I won't be furious about that either, but it seems like it'll be an opportunity missed to not get Keaton Parks in a game like that.
Yeah. Because it will be Parks who's the odd man out there, almost certainly.
Yes, yeah. Going back to the back line, do you think that's how Sarakin starts that back four? Or do you think he goes with Viafania and plays a little safer? In my mind, that's like a conservative manager being safe, taking what he knows.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think I'm like 50-50 on whether it's going to be Viafania or Robinson. I think the other three, I'm pretty sure that's what Sarakin will do, and I'm okay with it. But I don't know what he's going to do at left back.
I'm going to go crazy when we see Ole Sunday's name on starting line.
That'd be cool, I guess.
No, Ole Sunday's gone, isn't he? They kicked him out of the camp, or is he still there?
I can't remember. I should know that, but I don't.
No, I guess it could also be Lehigh, but no, I'm pretty sure Sarakin's going with Yedlin.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got the back line. We think Sarakin will pick. We think there's a good chance he'll start Trapp, even though we'd like to see Parks. Who do you see out wide then?
I think we'll see Saif. Is he back to full health now, or?
Yeah, I feel like there was a – they did announce that he was kept out of the Ireland. He wasn't on the 20-man list for the actual Ireland game, and I feel like they specified that he was out with an injury, and they specified one other guy is out with an injury, but they didn't say anything about Parks being injured.
Okay. So maybe Saif won't be fit. I mean, if Saif is fit, I'd like to see him out there. If he's not, I guess it's going to be Rubio again, right? I mean, Rubin. Is there another option?
I don't think so. I don't think Julian Green's going to be starting there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm with you. I'm the same. I'd like to see Seth out there if he's available. Again, just as an experiment, I feel like he passed his first test with the national team. So let's give him another one.
And I think especially if Robinson is there, Saif is a good partner for Robinson on the left flank, because Saif doesn't get to the end line really very often, but Robinson sure does, and Saif could combine with him and help cover for him because he's a sort of responsible adult as a defender.
As opposed to who would you have on your other wing?
Tim Weah.
Yeah, I'm
full of energy, and you know, I mean, he keeps providing a spark. I mean, he has his limitations, which I've been sort of quick to point out, but he provides a spark. His movement off the ball is really good. He probably knows all these French players to some extent or another. I mean, Mbappe is his teammate, and that'd be cool for him and his second home country. Maybe it's his third home country. I don't think he's probably spent a whole lot of time in Liberia in his lifetime.
I'm sure he's attended various first family ceremonies.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think at this point, especially, it looks like Sarakin's leaning that. I mean, Sarakin seems to be favoring Weah. So I fully expect him to be on the lineup.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. It's so cool that we have this other 18-year-old attacker with so much energy and good vibes around him, you know. Don't want that to get lost in all this tedious analysis.
Right. And when he first sort of came into the picture, even before he got his call-ups, when he made his start with PSG, I remember comparing him to Julian Green, because Julian Green similarly got on the field for Bayern Munich, which is a huge deal, you know, for US fans. And Julian Green then got called up to some friendlies for the US, and he looked completely overwhelmed. Like, he was falling down a lot, like, just couldn't keep his feet. The game was so fast. Mm-hmm. And that's where I feel like this has been a really exciting, like, experiment for Weah, because he is definitely not. He has looked like he knows what he's doing. He looks like he has a purpose every time he gets it. You can tell what he's trying to accomplish. And he's looked fairly clean. And so, yeah, it's been a good span of call-ups for Tim Weah.
Yeah, and your point about end product is a really good one. You know, just because he doesn't put it in the back of the net doesn't mean there's no end product, because he's found himself on the end of some really good chances, and he's been able to hit the ball hard, just hasn't put it in the right spot, except for the one time when he did score. And he's also gotten on the end of some moves and put the ball at the feet of a teammate, notably Josh Sargent, in position to score too. So, I mean, he's getting stuff done out there.
Yep.
Up top, I'll just go ahead and say I want it to be Josh Sargent. I thought Bobby Wood, like I said, played pretty well against Ireland, but it's becoming close to clear that Josh Sargent is a better player right now.
Yeah, so, and you could even say, like, I know the standard line is Sargent hasn't played a minute of first team soccer, but even with that being the case, you could probably say that he and Bobby Wood are at equivalent spots in their club standing. Bobby Wood's played, you know, plenty of first team soccer, and but his Bundesliga standing is probably about the same as Josh Sargent's right now.
Yeah. Well, he's not going to be playing in the Bundesliga next year, so he's even below Sargent in that respect. I mean, unless he gets a move to another club, which seems highly unlikely. And then this game is going to be over, and we're going to have nothing to talk about but the U.S. men's national team for a long time, man.
That's where we
pivot to build Mexico.
We pivot to Mexico and Panama. It's just going to be like a numbers game of monitoring U.S. youth prospects and just waiting for Reyna and Bello to finally come good.
Yeah.
Finally get called up to their first teams or make their big money moves overseas.
When we come back, we'll do a couple quick short corners. All right, we're back. Got a few quick bullets here in our short corners segment. First off, I want to mention Richie Ledesma, the 17-year-old midfielder for Real Monarchs, the USL side for Real Salt Lake. He, in his fifth appearance for the team, he got his first professional goal last night. It was a relatively simple finish, but he made it look even simpler than it was, slotting home coolly on a nice pass from the end line back across the box from veteran striker Chandler Hoffman. Now, I'm really high on Ledesma. I've been sort of beating the drum for him for the past few weeks or even longer. He's clearly in Tab Ramos's plans as part of the core of that U20 squad that's preparing for World Cup qualification in November and then the World Cup itself in the spring, late spring of 2019. Ledesma, Alex Mendez at the LA Galaxy, who's also having a really strong USL campaign, Andrew Carlton, Ulises Yanez, also at LA Galaxy, and then whoever they can figure out as a number nine. It's a really exciting sort of attacking squad. And I know I'm sort of deep in the weeds on this stuff, but I'm really excited about the U20s, and I guess we'll find out who's on their next roster in July or something.
Well, and Ledesma, going back to Ledesma, hasn't he sort of even been promoted throughout those five games where he started off coming off the bench and sort of slotting out wide in the last couple of games? He's been their starting playmaking midfielder.
Yeah, well, there's a little bit of an asterisk to that. He started as a 10 last week and played really well. I gifted a bunch of his touches in that game, but didn't get on the score sheet. And then the guy he started for, Sebastian Velasquez, came back from injury. And Velasquez has been like an MLS journeyman in his career. And I think he's the best player for the Monarchs. He started the game last night and then came off in the 16th minute with the same nagging ankle knock. And Ledesma came on for him. So Ledesma started on the bench.
Okay.
And then Ledesma scored like 8 minutes later. So he has been promoted a little bit, but I think he's benefiting a little bit from Velasquez's injuries. And it'll be interesting to see what happens when Velasquez is back to full health. Is Ledesma going to play on the wing? I don't even know, honestly, if he can play, make his MLS debut, because I don't think he has an MLS contract. I could be wrong on that. I don't know his agent.
Yeah, I was gonna say, well, you need to be really deep in the weeds if you know all the ins and outs of MLS contracts.
Yeah, I don't even know the sort of the first thing about Ledesma's situation. I just know he's not a homegrown, and he turns 18, I believe, either this summer or early fall. So I don't know if he's planning to go to Europe after he turns 18 or what. But the kid is really good. I think he's the best U20 sort of in that squad that I mentioned. And the U20s are going to be really interesting to follow because they got Chris Durkin. He qualifies in that age group. So does Tyler Adams. So does Jonathan Amon. And so does Josh Sargent. And my guess is none of those four is going to be available for the U20 tournament because it's not a FIFA officially sanctioned event. I mean, it's officially sanctioned, but clubs are not required to release players for it.
Right. And it's almost like a better sign that they aren't going to be released.
Right.
To be honest.
Right. But at the same time, we do want our teams to do well in these tournaments. I think Matt Doyle is the one who always points out, generally speaking, U20 success is a good indicator of future national team success. So not necessarily individual players, but like team success.
So I'll just, I would actually be interested kind of in doing this research if I can motivate myself to do it. The teams that do well in the U20 tournaments, my guess is very often don't have their best players available either because they'd be playing their best players to be playing with the club. So it's almost like if you're good at the U20 tournament with your second tier of players, who are the ones who are made available, that means you're going to have, you must have a very deep youth bench.
Yep. Totally true. I mean, Jadon Sancho, who was just absolutely lit things up for Dortmund in the last few months. He was on the England U17 team that won the U17 World Cup in India this last fall, but he was not released for the tournament, which I know was a cause of angst among our English brethren and sistren. That's totally true. Wes McKennie and Nick Taitagwe and Christian Pulisic could have been on the U20 roster for the U.S. in the 2017 World Cup. Obviously, none of them was released by their club. I mean, Pulisic for a really, really good reason. He was already with the senior team. But, you know, McKennie was just laboring in obscurity as a U19 for Schalke, and they wouldn't let him come over here. So,
yeah, anyway. So doing well in that tournament, minus usually your five or six best players is a good sign.
Yeah, I think it'll be great if the four, you know, the Durkin, Sargent, Amon, and Adams. I mean, Adams and Sargent seems pretty clear. They're not going to be playing any more U20 ball. But if Durkin and Amon are too good for it as well, that's great. We just need other folks to step up. And I think Ledesma is kind of the fastest rising star in that squad, and why his goal last night was kind of a good marker for us to say, hey, we see you, Richie. And I maybe describe what makes him so good, which is he's just so clean on the ball. I don't know if you've watched any of those clips, but he's so clean on the ball. He's so calm on the ball. He looks smoother than everybody else on the field playing for the best team in USL. And that's not something you can say for, I don't know, any of the other teenagers we're following in that league. He looks the best of them all, except for Efra Alvarez, who scores bangers by the dozen.
Yeah.
And plays for Mexico's U17.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's who we really want to get called up for our U20 World Cup.
Yeah. Yeah, which I mean, the short corners is turning into very, very long corners, but which reminds me, there was a great Brian Shireta had a good interview with Tab Ramos last week.
Oh, that's right.
Where he
missed that.
Where Ramos explained that the LA Galaxy asked him not to talk to Efra Alvarez when he was out there visiting Juliana's and Alex Mendez's families. Just to clarify, those three players are all teenagers playing for the LA Galaxy 2 who are Americans by birth. And that was kind of surprising. And it came a few days after an interview with the LA Galaxy 2 coach where they said, oh, they dropped Alvarez when he was 14, maybe because he wasn't athletic enough. And I think it seemed like Ramos was trying to sort of push back on that a little bit. But he said he agreed. He agreed. I'm not gonna pressure a 15-year-old to come play for us. Kind of Mexico might do that, but we don't do that. Seemed like it was kind of his message.
Yeah. To be honest, like even though it's almost having this saying that, you know, the approach by Ramos would be kind of the same as us not trying to get Jonathan Gonzalez to come back. Like I have more sympathy for Ramos's explanation in this case. Like if it, like you don't sort of go, I don't want to say intimidate, but like you just let the kid make his decision in that situation.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's tough, man. A 15-year-old kid, that's a lot. With Gonzalez at that point, he's a professional. He'd played, you know, 3 months into his pro season with first team club. So I don't know. It's a bit dicey, man. Like those are, again, the human side of it is can't just be sort of ignored.
Yeah, I agree. I thought, on one hand, I'm like, hey, he's going to be one of the best players ever born on American soil. We got to like stop at nothing, leave no stone unturned. But on the other hand, you know, when Ramos says that, I'm with you. I kind of, it makes me think like, hey, he is just 15. What are we gonna do? You know, let the kid have a little bit of space. And then in an encouraging sign, I saw Paul Tenorio tweeted out that Alvarez's agent said, you know, Ifra is happy playing with the Mexico national team right now, but he's keeping his options open and we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So I don't know what that bridge is, but hopefully Tab Ramos will be standing on it, waving an American flag.
I think that bridge is just the first cap tying call up for Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we can't get too tied up in knots about that. I mean, that's partly why I'm so excited about Ledesma, because he seems to be pretty firmly in the American camp, and he's kind of a new face that's, in my opinion, very, very promising.
All right, we'll get him. We'll get him on the list, Bills.
Yep, he's in my spreadsheet already. We're going to talk about the Ringer article by Matt Pence and Andrew Helms. Do you have any quick thoughts on that?
It's sort of the same with all the postmortems. I appreciate the digging that they did and the fact that they were able to get some guys going on the record. It was actually, there were plenty of bits in there that I just love. Like, I love Hercules Gomez, so I think he had one line quoted and it was just perfect. It's just such a
the one about Herc. How they played under Bradley.
Yes, yeah. So love Herc, and so I mean, I'm just appreciative to see sort of I like seeing underneath the hood a little bit, as limited as even these kinds of stories are. But it doesn't really tell us anything new about the, you know, like of course there was discord, like. You could tell from under Jurgen, of course, there was discord. Like it was obvious, you know, when Landon Donovan gets cut and Jurgen Klinsmann's son is like mocking him on Twitter. Like it's pretty obvious there's more to it than just soccer. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it didn't shed any light on that. The Bruce Arena's own failings in the qualification process, I think, again, are pretty obvious. I don't think we need to be behind the scenes to know that he made some poor player selections and poor player deployments and poor lineup and formation decisions. You know, it's almost like it's this investigation where everything's already out in the open.
Yeah. It does. You know, I really appreciated the article because it was clear they put a lot of work into it. They talked to a lot of people. It was well crafted.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when it comes down to, like, the fine details of who exactly is to blame and to what percentage, you know, reality is essentially unknowable. Even the people who are involved, if they're being completely honest, they don't really know who's like, is it 60% Klinsmann's fault, 20% Arena's fault, and 20% the players, or is it 70% Arena, 20%? I think that's what the argument is all about. How much is it Klinsmann's fault? How much is it Arena's fault? How much is it Gulati's fault? How much is it the players' fault? We'll never know because no one really knows at any point. It's just too reality is too complicated, and we'll never know.
Right, and it literally took all of those groups to fail to barely miss out on qualifying. Like if one of those, if one subset of people in the U.S. Soccer Federation had like put the team on their like we wouldn't be in this mess. We wouldn't be constantly revisiting who fucked up, how and when, and to what extent.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we should have a moratorium on postmortems from now on. A moratorium on postmortems from now on.
But totally worth it for that quote and then the Dempsey quote.
I just want to score goals and go fishing.
It's very close to, I'm just here to score bangers. But with the Dempsey fishing angle, it's just perfect.
It is. The greatest American player of all time and the greatest American who played soccer of all time, all in one. In my opinion, I think you're more of a Donovan guy, aren't you?
No, I am Dempsey all the way.
Okay.
I love Clint Dempsey.
CONCACAF is old. You texted me that screenshot a few days ago. Looks like Mexico, Costa Rica, and Panama are the oldest teams in the World Cup.
Yeah, so what it's not just Rafa Marquez. Costa Rica, I think starting is going to be starting a bunch of the same guys who started 4 years ago. I think they might have like 9 returning starters who are probably going to start again. So you have to wonder if this is just sort of a golden generation for Costa Rica. Panama trying to draw on whatever experience they have, because it's going to be their guile that's going to get them to advance out of this group.
Yeah, I guess I don't know what to take from it. Just the missing generation is maybe not just an American thing.
It's a continental issue.
Yeah. I mean, Mexico doesn't really have it, but.
No, I kind of assume Mexico is just buoyed by Rafa Marquez.
Yeah, I think that is the fact. We'll get in more into Mexico in the coming weeks, but they looked really good against, was it against Wales?
And then not quite as good against Scotland.
Yeah, I haven't been able to watch that Scotland game yet, but Giovanni Dos Santos got a goal, and apparently that got him in the roster. Even though he totally sucks in MLS.
I want Gio to start. I love the Dos Santos brothers. I want Vela and Gio to turn this World Cup into a Mexico party.
Yeah.
They're going to, by the way. They're going to, be the fresh air team because they play Sweden and South Korea and they're going to score 7 or 8 goals. It's going to be Mexico and Nigeria will be the feel-good teams of the tournament.
Yeah. I hope so. I mean, watching them against Wales last week, a game that ended in a scoreless draw, the way they attack is just breathtakingly fast and precise. It's just ping, 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 ping. Thoughtful passing, incisive passing, incredible technique, and then somebody's in a dangerous spot. It's a joy to watch. I hope we get to see a lot of that in the World Cup.
Yeah, that's the kind of game the globe appreciates.
Yeah.
Dude, I get more and more excited about that Mexico-Germany game.
Yeah,
it's good. And now that they don't have Sané, I probably would say Mexico is favored to win.
Bold. Bold.
That's why I was celebrating his omission. He was the one guy that could break down Mexico's vaunted defense.
Yeah. Vaunted it is not. Carlos Salcedo was kind of a train wreck towards the end of the Bundesliga season, I got to say. But enough about that. We got to get going. We've gone on way too long.
All right, short corners.
Short, long corners. We'll be back early next week after the France friendly. We'll probably give it a couple days to ruminate and then get at you early in the week. Until then, thanks for listening. See ya.